This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we speak with EPA Administrator Carol Browner. She says human health compels the adoption of proposed new air pollution standards, and the science is sound. Listener comments. And the U.S. and Canada are fighting over diminishing stocks of salmon. Talks have broken down, and Canada has detained U.S. ships. A portrait of the mountains of British Columbia. And the Earth calendar, we find stellar sea lion colonies by following our noses. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Carol Browner, administrator of the United States Environmental Protection Agency, has spent a busy couple of weeks defending the proposed tightening of clean air regulations relating to both ozone and particulate matter. She's testified before Congress and also taken on our critics in public fora. She's clear that the debate has not raised issues about the scientific validity of EPA's proposals. She also says that the budget deal is good news for EPA. We spoke with her in her office in Washington. Carol, you've been in a major scrap with respect to the clean air regs, in which the industry representatives have spent a lot of time attacking the science behind EPA's proposals. What is the strategy to deal with those attacks?
I think it's important to recognize that the Congress and every president since Richard Nixon has believed that the American people deserve public health clean air standards based on the best available science. EPA has proposed to update, if you will, two of the public health air standards, on one on ozone and one on particles, and it is based on more science than we've had for probably any decision we've ever made, 250 peer-reviewed published scientific reports.
And are they holding up pretty well as you see the opposition?
There have been any number of those in industry who oppose us, who have raised questions about this or that study or this or that conclusion in one of the published scientific peer-reviewed studies. What we have found in each and every instance is that these were questions that were part of the four-year scientific review. EPA looked to an outside panel of scientists, people from industry, universities, medical health experts, toxicologists, air specialists, and every single question that has been raised by anyone, including those who oppose us, was a question that was thoroughly considered and debated in the four-year process, and those panels reached agreement that the current standards for ozone, the current standards for particles, leave far too many people at risk in this country, that there's far too much aggravated asthma, bronchitis, respiratory illness, and in the case of fine particles, 15,000 premature deaths.
Politically, is the Congress swayed by any of the science, or do you think this is going to be determined on other matters?
The law, the Clean Air Act, is very, very clear. It says a public health standard based on the best available science. In the case of ozone, the standard hasn't been updated for 20 years. In the case of particles, for the better part of a decade. What EPA has proposed to do is based on what Congress, what President Nixon, President Carter, President Bush all told us to do. Evaluate the science and update the standards if necessary to protect the health of the American people.
Let's spend a moment on your agenda. You've been administrator now for the first Clinton administration. The second one has begun. What are you looking forward to in terms of your priorities in the coming months?
I have sought to really move the agency in a direction that recognizes the need for tough public health and environmental standards, whether it be air pollution, water pollution, toxic waste cleanup, recognizing most particularly that when we set these kind of standards, let's make sure the health of our children, who are frequently the most vulnerable, that their health is actually protected. Once we set a tough public health standard, then let's look for the common sense, the cost-effective ways to really reduce the problem. And let's make sure that we engage the public in that decision-making process. And so, for example, we want to continue to expand the public's right to know so that they can be an active participant in making decisions about how best to protect the health of their children, their community, their air, their water.
I know that one of the things you're working on is setting up a separate agency, or not agency, but division within EPA that would focus on children's health. Is that necessary in order to move the bureaucracy? Does one have to build these separate entities to get things moving?
I have created an Office of Children's Health to give the agency one place out of which we can direct a variety of efforts, whether it be our research, looking at the growing body of science that shows us that children are affected perhaps more so than adults when it comes to air pollution, understanding better the increase in asthma and aggravated asthma among our children, understanding that drinking water contaminants that may not affect an adult affect a child. It also gives us a place to ensure that we are using all of the tools available to us to really do what we think needs to be done based on the science in terms of protecting the health of our children.
Last year, as you pointed out, shutting down EPA seemed to be a congressional objective. The voters didn't seem to approve of that, and things are a little better this year. Do you anticipate smoother going in terms of your differences with the Congress over the next
year or so? In terms of the budget, there's very, very good news. As the President said repeatedly over the last year and a half, we can both balance the budget and protect our priorities, including education and the environment. The budget agreement, the bipartisan budget agreement announced by the President and congressional leadership in the last month, does exactly that. Specifically agreed to in that arrangement is funding for EPA's operations, specifically committed to. We're not going to find ourselves in that kind of debate that could result in a shutdown, if you will. I think it is a recognition on the part of the Congress that the American people continue to believe that part of what government should do is protect the things we all share, our air, our water, our land, and that you want a strong environmental agency able to set tough public health standards, able to take an enforcement action when those standards are violated, able to clean up the toxic waste dumps.
That was Carol Browner, Administrator of the United States Environmental Protection Agency. Joining us now with an update on our listener comments is Stephanie Goishman. Stephanie, what do we have this week?
Well, Peter, one caller spoke about our program on endocrine disruptors. These are the chemicals that affect human and animal reproductive systems. And his comment relates to a statement that more tests are needed.
They were talking about the book Our Stolen Future, and I disapprove heartily of this hubris that human beings are somehow immune to what can affect animals. And we see that chemicals in the environment are affecting animals. I don't think there's any question about that. The question seems to be, oh, but can it affect us? Well, obviously we use laboratory animals to test things to see what their effect on humans will be. Why this schizophrenic attitude that because it's something produced by industry or big business, it may affect animals, but it may not affect us? Well, may not isn't good enough.
That's all for this week, Peter.
We hope you'll share your comments with us. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Almost a shooting war. That's how the head of a fisherman's organization in the Pacific Northwest described the stalemate between the U.S. and Canada over salmon. Talks have broken off, and Canada has confiscated U.S. ships for failing to abide by their regulations. The basis of the dispute stems from declining numbers of salmon as fishing has increased and the quality of the environment has declined. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally has this report.
In the Pacific Northwest, salmon is a huge industry supporting whole communities, and salmon is a big part of many Native American cultures. A treaty exists between the U.S. and Canada, which is supposed to make sure both countries get their fair share of salmon. Jim Pipkin is with the U.S. Department of the Interior. He's been the chief U.S. negotiator for Pacific salmon until recently when the State Department took the lead as negotiations broke down.
There are two major issues under the Pacific Salmon Treaty. One has to do with conservation and the universally recognized need for conservation of salmon resources on the West Coast. The other major issue under the treaty is a kind of equitable sharing of the fisheries, since fish do in fact migrate along the coastline and tend to stray into waters that are fished by one country or the other that are not necessarily the country of origin.
But those goals have not been easy to achieve. Canadian officials say they are getting the short end of the stick as U.S. fishermen take more than their fair share of salmon. Brian Riddle is a research scientist for the Department of Fisheries in Canada. He says the salmon issue is complicated because when the fish leave their home river, they often migrate north into the territory of another country.
Salmon are highly migratory. The fisheries in Canada and the United States unavoidably intercept each other's fish, which means that we catch theirs and they catch our fish. And that, so the situation in the treaty is that both countries recognize that the United States intercepts more Canadian fish than Canada does of the United States.
And therein lies the controversy. Canada says the U.S. rivers they rely upon for salmon are in much worse shape than their own rivers, which in turn provides salmon to American fishermen. Therefore, American fishermen are taking more salmon than the Canadians, and that violates the treaty. These assertions are reportedly backed up by the New Zealand diplomat mediating the talks between the U.S. and Canada. Bringing fishing levels in balance would likely mean dramatic cuts in the number of salmon American fishermen could take. Already, some American fishermen have been forced to cut back or stop fishing altogether. Glenn Spain is the Northwest Regional Director of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations.
The U.S. has done a lousy job, frankly. We've crashed the stocks in the Columbia because of hydropower mismanagement, deliberate mismanagement for the purpose of gearing the entire Columbia River system toward irrigation, toward barge traffic, and away from salmon protection. The Columbia River is once was the most abundant salmon-producing river in the world, and now it's only a shadow of itself. And it's been systematically changed to be a series of stagnant ponds, for all practical purposes, stagnant reservoirs. It is no longer functioning like a river, and this is one of our main criticisms of the federal government in this process, is they're not fessing up to the fact that much of the crisis has been created by the United States. And you can trace it right down to what's been done or what's been failed to be done in the Columbia River.
But the official U.S. position denies any inequities. Jim Pipkin says salmon populations vary from year to year for a number of reasons. He says he'd like to see the U.S. and Canada base the number of salmon they catch on how many salmon are available in a given year.
We have proposed that all the regimes under the Pacific Salmon Treaty be based on abundance. And quite simply, that means that you would agree on a kind of share level expressed either as a percentage or as a harvest rate that each country would be entitled to. And then if abundance goes up or down, that is, if the absolute numbers of fish go up or down, that would be governed by the sharing level that you've agreed on.
Salmon habitat has been degraded by a wide variety of ills, like erosion caused by logging, mining, and agriculture. But Glenn Spain says by far the biggest threat to salmon are dams, because they prevent the fish from getting down rivers to the ocean. Today, the federal government spends millions to ship salmon by truck and barge to the sea, but the results have not been encouraging.
The primary problem for the Pacific Salmon Treaty, and this is right now pretty close to a shooting war with Canada, is the mismanagement in the Columbia River. That has been the linchpin in the whole problem. And the more we ignore the Columbia and the more we fail from the U.S. side to grapple with the fundamental issues, we're never going to get anywhere.
About the time negotiations between the U.S. and Canada broke off, Canada seized four U.S. ships for violating some of their fishing laws. The incident was reminiscent of what happened a little over 2 years ago when Canada impounded a Spanish vessel at gunpoint in international waters in the Atlantic. They said the ship was overfishing turbot. The incident prompted both countries to threaten breaking diplomatic ties with each other. Few expect the current impasse between U.S. and Canada to go that far, but as populations of salmon and other fish continue to decline, controversies like these are becoming more common. Meanwhile, the populations of salmon and the life of our rivers hang in the balance. For The Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
What do you think about the salmon fight? The Environment Show wants to know. Call our toll-free reaction line at 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Leave a message and one of our producers will get back to you. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Tell us what's on your mind or send us questions you have about the environment. You can visit us on the internet and hear The Environment Show anytime. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places which are special to us. For some, they're city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. In his book, Landscapes of the Interior, author Don Gayton found a piece of himself he had never known while camping alone. He presents a portrait of the mountains in British Columbia.
I set a fast pace up the trail, walking towards the first night in the mountains of southeastern British Columbia. The trail gained altitude steadily, making a series of switchbacks along the lower flanks of the massive Kokanee Ridge. Downslope on my left lay the creek, hidden by the trees but plainly audible when I stopped to listen. Beyond the creek, and sweeping upward again, was the parallel twin of the ridge that I was on, its naked granite peaks, now fawn-colored in the late summer sunlight. Far up ahead, these two parallel ridges converged, and my destination was the high, level saddle that lay at the center of that convergence. The trail rose through one last steep switchback. I climbed very deliberately over the last few feet, and then stepped out onto the open saddle. Here was lithosphere, the world of rock. I stood between the two jagged electric ridges, two continuous fractures of granite that were born in an ancient buckling of British Columbia's crust. The nervous energy that had propelled me up the trail's switchbacks was still with me. It was getting dark and I was alone on a mountain, so I turned my attention to finding a place to camp. A few hundred yards farther onto the saddle, I saw a small lake, a lovely mons cupped between the two converging ridges. I found a level spot for the tent, almost a promontory above the lake that was carpeted with elk sedge and moss. For the next 20 minutes, I busied myself arranging lantern and tent and sleeping bag, creating this odd little island of domesticity amongst a sea of rock. My concentration, in rapidly fading daylight, was total. Finally, I sat down in front of the erected tent, and the tension of the last several hours released. An unexpected and curious wave of emotion passed through me. I saw that I had unwittingly chosen to camp in the center of a magnificent twilight amphitheater. In front of me, amidst the rock rubble, lay a lake of darkening indigo glass. The two ridges that buttressed each side were still phosphorescing from departed sun, while the sky darkened steadily towards pure night. High above, on a vast proscenium arch, rode Venus and the great wheeling moon. A sudden, unexpected spasm caught my breath, held it for a brief, revealing moment, and then passed. For the next few minutes, I cried, uncontrollably, until a deep internal wellspring I had never known or acknowledged was finally and profoundly emptied.
Author Don Gayton, reading from his book Landscapes of the Interior, published by New Society Publishers. Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next. On the North Pacific coast of the U.S., Canada, and Russia, small cities of stellar sea lions have formed. It happens every year when the animals mate and give birth. Right now is about when the birthing is taking place. Richard Merrick heads stellar sea lion research for the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Well, biologically, this is the end of their reproductive cycle in the sense that this is the time when pups are being born. And that's pretty much the same throughout their range, which goes from southeast California all the way up through Alaska and into Russian waters. Beginning about the last week of May, running through the first week of July, pups are being born. And about a week or two after a pup is born, the female breeds again with another male, and the process starts over again.
Merrick says stellar sea lions spend much of their time in the water, where they're graceful animals known for their playfulness. They're often seen riding waves like a surfer. But when they get down to the business of mating and birthing, they head to shore. Like other marine mammals, stellar sea lions are much less graceful on land. They waddle around clumsily and communicate by barking. Merrick says you can find a stellar's colony by following your nose.
It's a unique experience. The northern rookeries are a lot different than the ones down south, where it's, the heat makes a real difference. You know, you got to realize that these animals are typically picking a place that doesn't get washed by water during the summer. So all the feces and all the blood and all the afterbirths, all these things collect, and the place develops a sort of unique aroma. And you can't avoid smelling it. In the north, where it rains more and it's wetter, you don't quite smell it so often, but when the sun comes out, it's very pungent. So you have that, and that's how we have been able to find some of the rookeries that are more inaccessible. There are places where the rookeries are backed by steep cliffs and trees. We can't really see them, but you can smell it. Other times, it's this constant din of sound that surrounds you. Even though the males aren't vending or trying to get territories, they frequently vocalize, and they have a deep, deep voice. You can hear these rumbles of their voices. And then the pups are calling for the moms. They're going, eh, 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 and the moms are calling back, and it's always this noise that's going on, and the smell. And then this visual turmoil that's frequently going on, particularly during the pupping season, when there's always, during the peak, a female giving birth. And when a female's giving birth, there's the female who's doing her thing. And then there's usually males or females around there who are stirred up by her behavior. And then there are frequently gulls who fly in, or eagles, or foxes, who are waiting for the possibility of finding something to happen, something to chew on.
Unfortunately, scenes like that one are becoming less common. Stellar sea lion populations have been declining for decades. Richard Merrick says their decline is still a mystery, but he has his suspicions.
This is unlike a lot of the endangered species where people just know exactly what's causing the decline. Here we've had a situation where we don't have a lot of dead animals, so we're not able to go out and say, yeah, clearly this is the problem, that they cut down too many trees. So we've worked through the shopping list of different things that it could be, and have been able to eliminate most of them, and we're down to this, what in some ways is the worst possible one, and it looks like it's a food problem. And I say worst possible because trying to change the amount of food that's available in the marine ecosystem is really difficult. So we can't just go out and fix things easily.
And stellar sea lions may not be alone. Declines in some whale populations may also be caused by a lack of food. Merrick says fishermen have helped the situation by not fishing in stellar's habitat. But more work still will have to be done. Meanwhile, if you're planning on taking a cruise to Alaska anytime soon, and if the odor wafting up from the kitchen is like the odor wafting from the shore, you better pick another cruise line. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Thank you. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, are U.S. environmental organizations part of a communist conspiracy to take over the country and the world? We speak with an author who believes they are. We talk green about environmental education. Is it sound teaching or brainwashing? And a Navajo song about Mother Earth and a father's son. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. For decades, Americans have been forming and joining organizations to protect wildlife, natural resources, and the environment. The Sierra Club and the National Audubon Society, for example, have roots that go back before the turn of the century. Some see these environmental organizations as purveyors of Nazi propaganda techniques bent on subjugating the country and the world under international communism. I talked to Holly Swanson about her book on the subject called Set Up and Sold Out, Find Out What Green Really Means. It's published by CIN in White City, Oregon. Holly, your book talks about the green movement in the United States, mm-hmm. and for people who haven't had a chance to read it, who are you referring to when you talk about the Greens?
Well, to most people, green still means the color to most Americans, but the Green Movement is a political movement. It is part of the Green Party. It's a combination of the environmental cause is somewhat the basis for the Green Party, and the Green Movement, to those who might not exactly understand the movement, is somewhat like the Nazi movement in Nazi Germany. It started out as a small political party and grew into the Nazi movement. And the Green Party and the environmental cause is turning into the Green Movement.
And
what most people don't understand is the Green Party and the Green Movement are essentially one.
So that includes, you've got a list of some of the national organizations in your book, the Children's Defense Fund, the National Audubon Society, Planned Parenthood, Sierra Club, that group. Those
yes.
are all part of the enterprise, as you see.
They're all part of the Green Movement, yes. Whether or not they're all connected to the political agenda, it seems that they are from the direction that these groups are going. However, I'm not sure that everyone involved in each of those groups understands the entire political agenda of the Greens.
Now, your book focuses to a large degree on the similarities and connections between the Green Movement, as you describe it,
mm-hmm.
and the and Hitler's ideology and his political methods. So what is that connection as you see it?
Well, essentially, it's an ingenious marketing program. My background is marketing and public relations, and quite by accident through the research process, I investigated and researched quite thoroughly the tactics and propaganda methods that Hitler used to promote the Nazi movement and what Lenin used also to create the Russian Revolution. And the Green program basically parallels that in some of the most interesting ways. For example, Hitler used the concept that the Earth was a living organism and that people would get on board to save the sacred soil of the fatherland. And the Greens are using the concept that it is Mother Earth, and you want to get on board with the Green Party to save the sacred living being, Gaia. And there's many other connections. Hitler stressed community, activism, volunteerism, so do the Greens. Hitler used children, basically. He indoctrinated children at a very young age through the schools to be activists in the Nazi movement. And unfortunately, in our schools, Earth Day and some of the other events that are taking place are indoctrinating a different set of values, green values, into our children.
One of the things that I think you argue is that this is also part of an effort to achieve communist control.
Well, I do believe that. I didn't intend to find that, but there are many, many connections between the goals of the Communist Party USA and what has evolved as the Green Movement. For instance, Gus Hall, the chairman of the National Communist Party USA, said in 1972, essentially, that the environmental cause, they needed to be the leaders and the organizers of the environmental cause because socialism was the only solution to the environmental problem. Capitalism could not solve it.
One of the things you say, and I'd just like you to elaborate on it, you say the Green Movement is not about cooperation and sharing. It's not about science. It's not about the environment. It's about communist control of America and the world. So, basically, is that what's happening here?
Well, let me answer that question this way. Just give a few examples. Karl Blois, a leading U.S. communist, said that the environmental movement promised to bring greater numbers into their orbit than the peace movement ever did. The president in 1953, the president of the Ford Foundation, H. Rowan Gaither, said, "We shall so use our grant-making power to so alter life in the United States that we can be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union." And right now, when you look at some of the green leaders, Mikhail Gorbachev is now positioned himself as a leader in the green movement, and he is pushing for global environmental laws that smack of world communism.
One of the things that you also expressed some concern about was what was going on in American entertainment. You pick out particularly the Pocahontas movie put out by Walt Disney. Mm-hmm. What should parents be worried about when it comes to that film?
Well, I think, again, children operate on emotion, and it's their innocence that is at stake here. The movie Pocahontas basically has the heroine as an eco-feminist out protecting the earth, and the story is, you can say it's a cartoon and it's not real, but when children see that, that is their historical reference. And Pocahontas was not a 20-year-old, beautiful, voluptuous young woman. She was a young Indian girl. And the whole storyline is about becoming an eco-heroine. And that's what appeals to the kids, and talking to trees and animals. And any of us, whether it's seeing Bambi or many of the Disney movies, know that that is impacting. I mean, they're very effective communication. And I think that what we need to realize and parents need to look out for is the subliminal green messages that are going across to your kids.
One of the things I noticed in looking at a flyer promoting Holly Swanson's book was a quote attributed to me when I was president of the National Audubon Society. The flyer quoted me as saying, "We don't believe in the concept of private property." The flyer did not contain the complete sentence, which was, "We don't believe in the concept of private property that gives the landowner unlimited rights to destroy the property of his neighbor." Ms. Swanson admitted that the quote was misleading, but her excuse was that she received it out of a newsletter. Again, we've been talking to Holly Swanson, author of the book Set Up and Sold Out. What do you think about her views? Are environmental organizations part of the process by which international communism is attempting to take over the country and the world using Nazi techniques? Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about environmental education. Is environmental education giving our kids an understanding of how the planet works and the environmental choices they'll be making? Or is it anti-business greenwash and green propaganda being foisted on a generation of students by environmental groups and ideologues? We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. I have two guests. Dr. Alan Berkowitz, he's the head of education at the Institute of Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook, New York. He's written books and curriculum guides in ecological science and education, and he's currently working on a team to develop environmental education guidelines for the North American Association for Environmental Education. Also with me is Michael Sonera. He's with the Claremont Institute, and he's co-author of the book Facts, Not Fear, which singles out what he believes is green ideological bias in environmental educational programs. Michael Sonera, let me start with you. For our listeners to have some understanding of this, what is your concern?
The concern is that when environmental education sticks to basic, what I call nature studies, or when it sticks closely to science and economics, it tends to be quite good and quite important for kids to get. I'm a Cub Scout leader, and I take my Cub Scout den out to nature centers here in Tucson, and we learn about quite a bit about the environment. The three areas where there are major problems are one, when environmental education gets into issues, when it gets into global warming, acid rain, rainforest, much of the materials, especially the textbooks that I have reviewed, and I've reviewed 130 of them, give a very one-sided and biased coverage of these issues. Much of the countervailing science is just completely ignored or left out. The second area is in behavior modification. There seems within the environmental education community this absolute demand or necessity to implement behavior modification to change children's lifestyles. And this is often abused and is not good education. The third area is in the political involvement of kids. Kids are mobilized for political narrow self-interest by groups who want to defeat or support particular environmental issues. So congressmen, state legislators, city council members are bombarded by kids who are concerned about an environmental issue. When you look into this in detail, what typically occurs is that the kids have only been presented one side, so that it's not their decision to get into this involvement. They're being taught what to think, not how to think.
Alan Berkowitz is someone who has been deeply involved in environmental education for a long period of time. How do you respond to the charges that Michael Cenero is making?
Well, I think it's really essential that we arm our children with the tools that they'll need to face the environment and the world that they are going to live in the 21st century. And I don't think there's much debate. I think even Michael Cenero agrees that part of that needs to be a set of skills and understandings of how the environment works and what their place in the environment is. And I think that environmental education has done a wonderful job in starting the task ahead of us. And we have a very exciting and very positive and forward-looking vision for how that can be accomplished even better in the future. And I think that the small problems that he points out, he, of course, doesn't think they're small, but to the extent that the problems that he points out might occur, it's a case of condemning an entire discipline for the mistakes of a very small number of people.
Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We want to hear from you. Nancy, you're talking green on the Environment Show.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. Where are you calling from?
Okay, I'm Nancy Berry, principal of Kramer Middle School of Environmental Studies in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
What is your comment or question to our panel?
Okay, just a comment. I guess the focal point that we're taking is an awareness with our students of the environment. We're also in the stage where we will develop our own curriculum rather than using existing textbooks and materials.
Excellent.
As it relates to, we're very close, we're in walking distance of the Anacostia River. So we want the children to learn about their own community that they walk around and work in and service. We also had a boat building, and the boat is very seaworthy. And so they're able to take it out and, you know, do their own sampling and discovering.
Well, Nancy, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
You're developing your own curriculum.
Yes.
Let's suppose you get a lot of material from the Western Fuels Institute, and I'm oversimplifying now, that
okay.
basically says that global warming is not a problem, and you get an equal amount of material from many members of the scientific community that says that it is.
Okay.
How do you put all that together?
Together?
And I'd be interested in our panelists commenting on how you're going to deal with this. So let's start with you. How are you going to deal with these issues, some of which are polarized, not only on scientific issues, but because of the politics and the economics
right.
behind them?
Well, rather than coming out with being a for or an against person, students need to start out with a definition. And again, I go back to the word awareness. And then they are able to form, as they get older, what opinions they may have. So we're not pushing one side or the other. We just want, by definition, an explanation.
And would you also feel compelled to indicate the source of some of the materials that you're using so the students can evaluate it as well?
No, I don't think we're going down evaluation and where it comes from, just knowledge base.
Alan Berkowitz, how is that as an approach? Does it make sense to you?
Well, I completely applaud her efforts, and I'm actually aware of what they're doing in focusing a lot of their attention to the local environment there. The schools in D.C. have a good reputation for doing that. And I also agree that building on from awareness to understanding and building based on understanding of local environment is really excellent. On the other hand, I don't think that you've characterized two sides of an issue as if those two sides have the same kind of credibility. And in the case of the scientific community, there is actual consensus among the scientific community that global warming is a problem. And to kind of portray that as one side of an issue is a misstatement of our understanding of the world. And so I think if you did present both sides without it, saying one side had the scientists' support and the other was from an industry source, I think you'd be doing a disservice to building the students' understanding of
okay.
of
right, and I agree. I agree, and I think I have no problem with presenting that. I guess what I'm saying is I would not present it and be one-sided about it. I would like for the students, if they want to carry it further, then it would be their decision, but we've presented them with both sides, hopefully equally. And then it is a challenge for them to take it on and carry it however they feel.
Nancy, how do you feel about the issue that Michael Cenera raised about kids writing their congresspeople and so on? Is that part of becoming an environmentalist in your view or not?
I guess I would look at it as a skill. If we had some children that felt very strongly about an issue, then I'm going to look at it educationally. I mean, there's letter writing. They want a response. They learn how information can go out, and then when it comes back, what you can do with it. It's like a life learning experience rather than let's stick to the issue, let's push the point, let's get everyone on our wagon. I would like for them to learn a lot of skills with that one exercise.
Great. Well, thanks for your call, and I want to go clear across the country now to Barbara in California. Welcome. You're Talking Green on the Environment Show.
Hi, this is Barbara Bohart. I co-authored the report that was published in the Washington Post called Endangered Education, and it studied the attack on environmental education. I would like to actually pose a question to Mr. Cenera. Usually he portrays the attack, as the other speaker pointed out, usually he comes out and brings in stories about how kids becoming activists or changing their behavior is a bad thing. One such of these stories is his issue with students in Arizona, where they who were studying nature in their schoolyard and had a difficult time when the plants they were studying, including a protected cactus, were raised by a developer. The teachers who were trying to help the students cope with the issue, presented both sides of the picture, the developer side, the fact that houses were being built, and also the fact that this open space, this land, and the plant that they so loved was being destroyed. In the process of events, the students wrote letters to the newspaper for either side if they wanted to. And when the teacher was written to, and there was complaint that he did not show the economic side, which he had. He again went over the economic side.
So your question then is?
Is how this, I mean, how teaching kids to kind of participate in democracy, how is this a negative thing when the kids learn how the process works?
Okay.
Well, because they're not learning how the process works. They're given a factually distorted picture that does not meet the guidelines put out by the largest professional association.
Can I finish?
And I think the story, as you related in your report, proves my point. The issue cast to the students was one between the environment and the developer, and that is not education. The issue is not between the environment and the developer. The issue is between basic economic principles and trade-offs that students need to consider. The key question that your report failed to cover was whether or not the teacher ever in that experience asked the students if they liked living in their homes. And I live in Tucson, not very far from the school.
Okay, Alan Berkowitz, let's have you.
In their homes, which were not very many years before, just a handful of years, also living on desert land. They didn't bring it home to the students that they perhaps were living on homes which were also living on virgin desert land.
Got it. Okay. Alan Berkowitz to respond to that, because that obviously has to do with a pedagogical approach of the teacher as to what questions are presented.
Yeah, I think that we need to take a slightly larger view here rather than focusing just on this one example. And we need to ask ourselves, what kinds of understandings do children and eventually citizens need in order to act responsibly by as defined by their own sets of values and feelings towards the environment? And in order to do that, they have to have experiences like the one that's being described here. And it has to be dealt with in its from as many perspectives as possible. So if again, you have one anecdote where this person didn't do it exactly the way you would want, and I suggest that this is a problem that will turn up in any kind of teaching.
Our time is short, and we have a call from California. I want to take Barbara. You're talking green in the Environment Show.
Yes, thank you. What we found in our report is that, in fact, the attack on environmental education that is a national and local media campaign that by Mr. Sonera's organization and several other organizations, we found it's funded by corporate polluters.
You say we found.
Yes.
Who is we?
We're for the Center for Commercial Free Public Education.
I see.
We're located in Oakland, California.
And you wrote a report about Mr. Sonera's book. Is that it?
Right. And we found that it's that his research, his organization, and several of the other organizations that are attacking environmental education are funded by corporate polluters.
Okay, I'm going to cut you off so that Mr. Sonera can respond because our time is short. Mr. Sonera?
Yes, I love this report because it over and over and over again proves my point. They point out that my organization and several other organizations have taken money from oil companies. But what they fail to point out is that the largest organization of professional environmental educators, the NAAEE, which I assume Alan Berkowitz is also a member of, takes money from Phillips 66, Chevron, and Clorox. So the critics need to respond to the fact that why is it that our research is somehow biased when other organizations take money from these same organizations and their activities are not somehow biased.
Okay, I think you make the point. Well, Alan, I'm going to ask you to give us a sense both of a comment on what you just heard and then your overall view of whether environmental education as it is now practiced in the United States is unbiased or is reasonably effective as a sound educational process.
Well, I think that the kind of debate that we're having is exactly what needs to be happening in school. And in order to do that, children need to have repeated and a nice developmental sequence of experiences that builds on their biological, physical, social understanding of the world around them so that they can identify bias, so that they can identify perspectives, and that they can build their own ethic and then act on it responsibly. I think environmental education has made tremendous strides in that. I think the evidence for that is clear in the improvements that we've made in our environment and in trying to address the building distance between people and the environment that our increasing urbanization is posing us with. So environmental education is essential so that we can have control over the very important decisions that we're already making all the time from the perspectives that Michael Sonera is bringing up, the economic, ethical, biological, and social perspectives.
I wish we could do it all, but our time is up. And thank you. I've been talking with Dr. Alan Berkowitz, who is head of education at the Institute of Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook, and Michael Sonera, who is with the Claremont Institute and author of the book Facts Not Fear. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. This is Talking Green on the Environment Show, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Educating our children about the environment is a tough job, especially when so many of us live lives away from the natural world. For the Navajos of the American Southwest, there was no place outside of nature. Everything one could teach a child was found in the environment of the Southwest. Sharon Birch is a Navajo singer-songwriter. She performs her song, Earth and Sun, which she wrote for her sister's wedding. It appears on her CD, Touch the Sweet Earth. The lyrics are in Navajo and translate to Father Sun and Mother Earth, in unison they travel, in unison they travel, in unison they travel.
Hey, and
Earth and Sun by Sharon Birch from her album Touch the Sweet Earth on Canyon Records. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 388. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Caplet Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.